Che?
Okay, welcome back to Math 3013. Hold on. It's me. All right, so let's see. Let me share the screen. Okay. Good. So, see, I hope you all can hear me. I'm getting this thing all set up, chat going. Okay. So, today what I'll do is I'll do a quick recap of what went on Monday and Tuesday this week. And then we're going to explore a third operation we can perform on vectors. We can already add them and scale or multiply, but there's another operation called the dot product that is useful for extracting geometric information about vectors. So I'll discuss that, and then we'll conclude this week's lecture with a discussion of the really basic geometric objects that occur in linear algebra. They're very simple. Nothing as exotic as even a sphere occurs naturally in linear algebra. Rather, what we focus on are really points, lines, and flat planes, or and generalizations of those objects. Okay, so let me begin by asking if there are any questions. I will point out, initially I had the first homework assignment due next Wednesday. I've already delayed that until a week from today. So Friday. So you'll have all of the holiday weekend to work on the homework, as well as some additional time next week. And perhaps on Wednesday next week, I'll maybe do some of the WebAssign problems explicitly in class, so you see how that mechanism works. Okay, so let's get started. What happened on Monday and Tuesday? Well, we introduced the principal objects of this course, which are vectors, which could be a number of things, as we've seen. Quantities with magnitude and direction, they could be directed line segments, or, and this is the principal way we'll regard vectors in this course, as ordered lists of numbers. So I'll typically write these guys by using square brackets to denote an ordered list, putting the elements of that list inside in their particular order. All right. Write down a set of numbers and I enclose it in square brackets, that's going to constitute a vector. All right. What's nice about these vectors, of course, because we're using numbers all the time, is they're going to be eminently capable of being calculable objects. They'll have numbers that we can add, subtract, divide, etc. Okay. Now, occasionally, we'll depict vectors as directed line segments. But that's primarily not for calculation, but rather so we can visualize and get some intuitive understanding of what's going on. Otherwise, we're just staring at numbers and it doesn't really offer that much intuition. All right, so notation. I use this funny R to denote a set of real numbers. And if I put a superscript there, I'm looking at a different object. I'm looking at the set of all possible n-dimensional vectors, which you should interpret as all possible ways of writing a list of n real numbers. Okay, so and then here's our set theoretical notation that we'll use throughout the semester. The way I construct sets is, first of all, make sure they're explicitly sets by closing the elements inside curly braces, distinct from the square braces up here. And then for this set of all n-dimensional vectors, well, each vector is going to be a list of n real numbers. So here's a list of n objects. And then this middle, this vertical slash in the middle is to be read as such that. So Rn is a set of lists of n objects, where each of the objects, V1 through Vn, is a real number. So it's a long way of stating verbally, but a simple way of denoting mathematically through our notation what our principal objects are, lists of n real numbers. Okay, and then we also discussed the two fundamental vector operations. They're very simple. We can add vectors, that's simply by adding similar components to one another and writing the result as another list of n numbers. And scalar multiplication is very easy as well. You have a number lambda and an n-dimensional vector, v1 through vn. The scalar multiple of that vector by the number lambda is just going to be the list of n numbers you get by multiplying each of the elements of the original list by the number lambda. Okay, now, one nice thing about these two formulas here is that once they're established and declared, they satisfy a number of easy identities that basically are boiled down to properties of real numbers. So let me start listing them. So first of all, when we add vectors, the order in which we write the vectors down, whether we write u plus v or v plus u, is immaterial to the result. That property is actually a property of this addition. It's called commutativity of vector addition. A second property, well, our definitions tell us how to combine two, vector addition tells us how to combine two vectors. If we want to combine three vectors using our two vector rule, we are going to have to decide on whether to add three vectors. Do I first add the two vectors and then the third, or do I add the last two vectors before adding the first vector to it? So these could be different depending on how this notion of vector addition is defined, but it turns out that with this notion of vector addition, it doesn't matter how you group things. The result of adding three vectors together using the two vector rule is going to be not going to have any consequence. You'll get the same result no matter how you group the vectors. Then if you introduce the zero vector, which is just the vector for which every component is equal to zero, and you add that to an arbitrary vector u, you always get back that vector u. So that's called the existence of an additive identity. You can add something to u without changing u. Then we also have added inverses. If I add to u, it's scalar multiplied by -1, I always get the zero vector. So u will have an additive inverse. There'll be another vector that I can add to u that will produce zero, and in fact, it's exactly -1 times u. The fourth property, that we can distribute scalar multiplication over this vector addition, right? Now this plus sign, where I'm adding vectors, is different than this is not the simple distributive law for real numbers, because the addition here is addition of vectors. But now we can distribute multiplication over vectors, and we can distribute the addition of real numbers over scalar multiplication. And we can have compatibility of scalar multiplication with vector addition. So here, what I do on the on the left-hand side here is I multiply u times d using scalar multiplication, using this definition, right? And then I multiply again by c. And the claim is I get the same result as if I first multiplied c and d together before actually carrying out the scalar multiplication. And lastly, 1 times a vector is equal to a vector. Now, each of these properties is really simple, in fact, quite trivial to prove using these definitions of what it means to add vectors and scalar multiply vectors. Let me give you an example. So if I want to show that addition is commutative, what I'll do is I'll plug in explicitly for u and d using their expression as ordered lists, right? So now u plus d is going to be this list plus this list. And our rule for combining lists of numbers via vector addition is to add similar components. So the result of adding u to d is going to be this vector here. But then, because inside each of these components, we're just adding real numbers, I can use the property that addition is commutative inside the real number. So I can reverse these sums inside, but notice that the plus sign here on the left-hand side is addition of vectors, but while I'm working inside the vector in terms of its individual components, the plus sign here that I'm circling is now addition of real numbers, which is commutative. And then I could take this vector and break it apart into 2 summands. And now you've seen, I've demonstrated that the vector sum of u plus d is the same as the vector sum of d plus u. And in fact, each of these 8 properties can be verified by simply substituting in for these symbols, boldface u, boldface d, ordered lists such as this, and then calculating both sides and seeing that in fact it's true, the identity is true. All right, so this is not such a formal proof course, and I'm not going to have you prove all 8 identities, but I do want to remark that these formal identities are going to be really important to us about midway through the course when we start to think about vector spaces other than ordered lists of numbers. What we're going to find is that anytime we have a set where we have 2 operations of vector addition and scalar multiplication defined. So here, I want you to think of, well, I've given you an example of you can think of oscillations or sound waves as acting like vectors. And in fact, you add sound waves by combining sounds together the way individual instruments, their sounds combine to create an orchestra, and scalar multiplication has to do with maybe increasing the amplitude of an oscillation or decreasing the amplitude, possibly reversing its phase if you're multiplying by a negative number. We've seen that we have other sets that behave somewhat like vectors and even have vector addition and scalar multiplication. What we'll find though is that if we have a set, some abstract set, for which we do have some notion of vector addition and some notion of scalar multiplication, and in fact, identities like this are now defined for these abstract vectors and their abstract notion of addition and scalar multiplication, then they're going to behave, as far as linear algebra goes, exactly like the vector space that we're used to at that point in the course, the vector space Rn. And moreover, if we want to calculate in these more general vector spaces, what we'll be able to do is exploit the type connection between Rn and our abstract vector space and pull our calculations back to this readily calculable setting where all we're doing is manipulating lists of numbers. Okay, so that is more of a preview of the more formal part of the course that comes about midway. But I just wanted to point that out at this stage of the game. We'll be considering much more interesting things later on, But the first thing we're going to establish in this course is the calculational setting upon which everything depends. Okay, so I see some people are saying that they could not hear the sound and there were suggestions to exit Zoom and try again. Are people back and capable of hearing me? Okay, good. All right, thank you. Keep those questions coming in. I'll glance at the chat every once in a while. And hopefully, if you speak up, I'll be able to hear you as well.
I have a question. Would you mind giving me an example of vector addition, like with real numbers?
Oh, sure. It's simple to do. So we're going to represent vectors as lists, right? So here's a vector and a list of two numbers. And let's add it to a list of another pair of real numbers. Well, all you do is add it component by component. So the first component of the result is going to be the sum of the first components of the individual summons. And the second component is going to be 2 plus the square root of 2, or I guess minus the square root of 2. All right, does that show up? You may have to, let me stop the share and then you'll see.
I can see it.
Oh, sorry, you can see it? Okay, good.
Thank you.
So in fact, that's a real good question because we're going to talk about vectors, and oftentimes I'm just going to say the word or put a symbol for a vector down, but it's really crucial to always think of them as ordered lists of numbers in this stage of the course, because these are the things we can directly calculate with and we'll get nice concrete answers. So it will really provide us with a firm foundation for all the abstraction that comes later. Okay, so there's one more operation that we can perform. Well, there's other operations besides the dot product, but one more principal operation that we'll sometimes have recourse to in this course. It's the so-called dot product of vectors. It's another operation. So here you have to recall our notation. Now, when I put this time symbol, this X between two sets, it means I'm considering pairs of elements. One element from the first set paired with another element, the second set. So what the dot product is, the way to think about it, it's a certain function that takes pairs of vectors and produces a real number. So there's no superscript here. So it's taking two vectors and it's producing a real number. All right, so what is it? Well, in this course, where we think of vectors as ordered lists of numbers, we'll define it in this fashion. So this ordered list dotted with this ordered list produces a number. That number is just the product of the first components of each vector summed with the product of the second components, summed with the product of the third components until we've exhausted all the components. All right, so notice in this definition of the dot product, as soon as we have a list of numbers, or two lists of numbers, one for each factor here, we can compute explicitly a numerical value for the dot product. This dot product is going to be used to extract geometric information about our ordered lists of numbers. How so? Well, it's because, let me just remark here that I'm more or less introducing new notation. When I sum a bunch of numbers up, I'll often use this summation symbol to indicate the sum. So what this symbol means is, well, I'm going to add up a bunch of terms. And the way I create that is I'm going to iterate over this index I. So each of my vectors has components that are labeled by indexes, 1, 2, 3, up to n. And so what I do to calculate this dot product is I multiply together components with the same index, and then I sum them all up. So that's the notion, brief explanation of that summation notation. But now let me give you the geometric version of what the dot product is. This is the one you're probably most familiar with from, say, your physics or engineering class. The dot product of two vectors is going to be the length of one vector times the length of the other vector times the cosine of the angle between the two vectors. So you can think of this geometrically. Here's two vectors, vector A and a vector B, and then an angle between the two vectors, all right? And then the statement in this geometric version is I can calculate the dot product of these two geometric vectors by measuring the length of A, measuring the length of B, and then measuring the angle between the two vectors. With that, I have all the data I need to compute explicitly on my calculator the value of A dot B. But if I think of a vector as an ordered list of numbers, I have a different procedure for calculating the same dot product. It's just that I sum the pairwise product of all the components. All right, what's nice about this is having two different versions of the dot product, it allows us to interpret the linear algebraic version geometrically. So let me show you, and that's gonna be really useful to us because while I can draw two-dimensional vectors as vectors in a plane, right? If I wanted to draw this vector 2, 3, so that's it written as an order list of number. If I want to draw it as a direct I simply go two steps in the horizontal direction, three steps in the vertical direction, and I draw a directed line segment going from the origin to the point.
Could you move your paper down, please?
Sure, there you go.
Thank you.
So this numerical vector can be written, is easily converted into a geometric vector. And when you do so, these two definitions are actually compatible with one another. But that, I can only do this explicitly when I'm working on a piece of paper, because it's difficult to draw three-dimensional vectors on a piece of paper, and I think impossible to draw a four-dimensional vector on a flat two-dimensional piece of paper. And so, in fact, I won't be able to measure lengths and angles if I'm dealing with four-dimensional vectors. I have no four-dimensional protractor nor a four-dimensional ruler to work with. Okay, but because these are all essentially both vectors, and we can pass back and forth between their description as directed line segments or as ordered lists of numbers, this formula here allows us to ascribe a geometric interpretation to vectors in a higher dimensional space. So here's how we do that. We start with a geometric rule, and then we use it to solve for these various geometric information. For example, if I want the length of A, let's take this formula and substitute for the vector B, the vector A. And so A dot with A is going to be...
Excuse me, sir. We cannot see the bottom of the page.
Oh, you here?
Yep. Thank you.
Right, sure. So I can use the geometric formula here, and I can use it. So what I've done here is let me start with a new page here. Here, if A dot with A, sorry, that's got to show up. If that's equal to the magnitude of A times the magnitude of A times the cosine, the angle between A and itself, well, this angle is going to be 0 degrees, and the cosine of 0 degrees is going to be a factor of 1. And this is just the length squared. So A dot with A is just going to be the length squared. But I have an alternative way of computing the dot product of A. I don't have to actually measure lengths and angles. I can use the components instead. And so now I have a way of defining the length of an n-dimensional vector by simply taking its dot product with itself, that's given by this formula, and then taking the square root. And similarly, I can calculate angles in a higher dimensional space. What I do is I take the geometric formula, I solve for the angle. Well, here I've done some algebra to isolate theta on one side of the equation, but it's coming directly from this definition of the geometric version of the dot product. And then because I have a formula for the algebraic version of the dot product, just substitute in, what you see is that now, if I know the components of the vector A and B as ordered lists of numbers, I can now compute the angle between A and B. So the dot product allows us to extend our geometric intuition involving lengths and angles of vectors. It allows us to extend that sort of thinking into higher dimensional spaces. We can explicitly calculate the length and angles between vectors by evaluating their dot products. We just don't use protractors and rulers to measure these things. Rather, we use the components of the vectors to calculate them. All right, so here's a quick example. Here's a vector. It's a four-dimensional vector. I do not have a four-dimensional ruler, so how am I going to measure its length? Well, I simply take its dot product with itself, realize that its dot product with itself is the square of its length, and so I carry out the algebra, solve for the length itself, and I see it's equal to the square root of 6, because the dot product of A with itself is equal to 6. And similarly, if I have two four-dimensional vectors and I want to know the angle between them, well, I'm going to use the geometric formula, but let's compute the individual pieces. Here I computed the length of A using the inner product of A with itself, as a thinking of A as this list of numbers. And similarly, I calculate the length of B, and then I also can calculate the dot product of A and B. And now here in the center here, I have my geometric formula. A dot B has to be the same as the length of A and the length of B times the cosine of the angle. All right, so what I'm doing on the right here is I'm substituting in for the length of A as computed from the components of A, the length of B as computed from the components of B, and I'm also substituting on the right-hand side the value of A dot B using the components of A and B. So since 1 is equal to A dot B, and A dot B is also equal to 2 times the square root of 7 times the cosine of the angle, I can use this last equation to solve for that angle. And so when we do so, we find that the angle between these two numerical vectors is effectively 79.1 degrees. So we can actually do geometry, length and angles, even in our higher dimensional space, but we'll use the dot product to convert lengths, convert to lengths and angles, the geometric information.
Is there a formula sheet with all these formulas on it?
Well, yes. The lecture slides are all posted on Canvas. So yeah, you have a complete set of notes for each of these lectures.
Okay.
Okay, so so now I want to think about the geometry of vectors in a different way. I'll now show you how to go from vectors to simple geometric objects. And the kind of geometric objects we're going to consider here are going to be really, really simple. Kind of the basic things about which you make all of geometry. We'll start with talking about points, then we may be thinking about an infinite set of points, but the simplest construction of an infinite set of points might be a line. And so I'll tell you how you think about lines in vectors. And then we'll generalize that to planes and higher dimensional objects. Okay, so let's start. Okay, so the first point, sorry for the pun there, is that vectors correspond to points in the plane, right? By a point in a plane, we just need a single dot somewhere existing in the plane. And naturally, these correspond to vectors because once we choose the coordinate system, we draw a directed line segment from the origin to the point in question. We've got that point prescribed by this vector, and a different point would be correspond to a different vector. Okay, so drawing things on a piece of paper, points correspond to vectors, and we'll think of this more generally. For example, points in a three-dimensional space, well, to describe those, you'd have to give their horizontal x position, their horizontal y position, and their vertical z position. Then you describe the point in a three-dimensional space, but that data also will constitute an ordered list. If we always use the first component to represent the x-coordinate, the second component for the y-component, the third component for the z-component, we'll always associate to a given point in space an ordered list of three numbers. But that easily generalizes to vectors in an n-dimensional space. We'll just use n coordinates. Those n coordinates will then form an ordered list of n numbers, and so a vector in our linear algebraic sets. Points in Rn, or points in an n-dimensional space, are going to be equivalent to ordered lists of n numbers. All right, simple enough. Now, what about lines? Lines are actually consist of an infinite set of vectors. So let me show you a way of constructing a line using linear algebra. All right, so let's give ourselves the coordinate system to work with. Here's a point. Now let's look at a line that passes through that point. I have a straight edge here. Yes, this will do. There, let me write a line that passes through that point. So actually, now this line, when I convert the vectors, actually consists of a whole bunch of directed line segments, right? All in reference to this common origin, but you see this line actually contains or corresponds to an infinite set of vectors. Let me show you how you construct each of these vectors using linear algebra. You start with a starting point, so let's call this initial point P0. And then what I'm going to do is I'm going to add to it P0, a scalar multiple by a parameter t of a certain vector d. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to write d as a vector heading off in this direction. So what's the rule for adding vectors geometrically? You take your first vector, you write it down, and then you take the base of the second vector, you put it at the tip of the first vector, and you follow that vector out. So maybe this point here, this line from the origin to this point, might be P0 plus D. But if I make this vector longer by multiplying it by a positive number T, well, what that means is I stray further and further from the P0 once I add this vector T times D to it. So I go further down this way by using larger values of T. Or if I multiply D by a negative number, that's gonna not change its overall direction, it'll reverse, it will exactly reverse its direction. So maybe a point here, let's draw the vector, could be thought of as P0 plus minus D, right? It's gonna head in the same direction as D, but well, not quite the same. It's gonna be 180 degrees different than the original vector D. And if I make T a larger negative number, well, it just means I'm gonna move further off in this direction, but it'll still be on the same line. So, We'll think of lines in this course as a particular set of vectors. It's always going to be constructed as a starting point, which we'll call P0, and we allow ourselves to stray from that starting point in a particular direction D. But the distance in that direction D that we stray, we leave that arbitrary so that we fill out the entire line. All right, so in linear algebra, a line is a set of vectors of this form. Of course, there's other ways of thinking about vectors. In this way, in this description, we're thinking of the line through the point P0 in the direction of D. But there's other ways of describing lines. If I give you exactly two points in the plane, there's exactly one line that passes between them, right? There's only one way I can put, there's only one line that's going to contain both of these points. Well, if I know these points, I can actually compute the linear algebraic line this way. Here's what it looks like. It's this set, right? It's effectively a vector plus an arbitrary parameter times another vector. It's of the same form as we have here, but note that when t is equal to 0, the second term does not contribute. And so when t is equal to 0, the corresponding point is simply the vector A. So every point on the line has the form A plus t times B minus A. When t is equal to 0, what you're going to get is A. So this point lives on the line.
We cannot see the paper.
Sorry. And when t is equal to 1, well, we'll have A plus 1 times B minus A. And here the A's are going to cancel, and you're left with B. So for special values of t, we see both A and the point B lie on that line. And so even when you introduce a line or prescribe a line as passing through two points, the points on that line can all be written in this form. In calculus and other subjects, you might think of a line as a special kind of curve, a way of, for each value of t, getting a point in the two-dimensional space. And if the components are actually linear functions of t, you actually get a line. So here's what we might call a parameterized curve. For each value of t, I get a vector in a three-dimensional space, and by varying the parameter t, I'm gonna get, over the entire real line, I'm gonna get an infinite set of vectors. But it's still of this basic form. All you have to do to see that, yes, let's take that parametric form and break it up. If your line consists of all the points you can reach by going, A1 plus t times D1, second component A2 plus t times D2. So I'm just using linear functions for all the components of this parameterization of the points on the line. What you can do is you can...
We cannot see the paper.
Sorry, this is double thing. Sorry, there, that should show it up. Okay, so what you can do is collect together all the components that don't contain t into one term, and then add to it all the terms that involve t, and then you can think of this as the vector A, and then this is a scalar multiple of a vector with components d1 through dn by t. And so again, even when you think of a line as a linear curve embedded in a high dimensional space, it still has this basic form, a point plus some parameter times a another vector. All right, so we're gonna think of, we're constantly gonna rethink of this form as the our basic definition of what a line is in linear algebra. Not only because these other ways of writing down lines are equivalent to this, because this one generalizes very nicely to higher dimensional objects. So let's consider, for example, what it would mean to have a plane. Well, to get a plane, I'll think of this sheet of paper as being a flat two-dimensional plane. Let's pick a starting point, and maybe we go a little, have one direction, call it D1. And now I'm gonna allow myself to go not in just a single direction from this point, but two different directions. And when I do so, I can reach every point on the entire plane here by going a little bit in this direction and another bit in this direction. For example, the point here, how would I reach? Well, I guess I would go, the idea is to realize this point as being a vertex of a parallelogram with sides that are parallel to these two guys. So I guess it's gonna look, let me do something a little bit more obvious. Let's look at this point here. So I guess I get a parallelogram by drawing that line there. That's, sorry, it's supposed to be parallel to this line and here. So this side here is parallel to this direction of D2. So it's gonna be some multiple of D2. And this side here is parallel to the direction of D1. So it'll be some multiple of D1. And now I've got the point here in the plane described as a certain multiple of the vector D1 plus a certain multiple of the vector D2. And so that's how we get planes, by taking a given point and straying from that in arbitrary distance along two different directions. Now we can create even higher dimensional objects. All we do is if we keep increasing the number of directions from which we can depart from our starting point P0. Right, and so now what you'll see is that whether we're thinking about points, lines, planes, they're all gonna have the same basic form. Here's a point, a single vector. Here's a line. It's gonna be a single vector plus the ability to add on a vector of arbitrary length along a certain direction. That will form a line. To get a plane, well, similar construction. We start with a point and then we allow ourselves to stray from that point now in two directions. And for higher dimensional hyperplanes, we just introduce more directions from which we can depart from our initial starting point. So we'll always think of our geometric objects, the basic geometric objects in linear algebra, are always gonna be the general hyperplanes. And by simply restricting the number of directions in that hyperplane, we can talk on its essentially the same footing about points, lines, and planes, and even higher dimensional objects. For planes, D1 and D2 need to be linearly independent. Yes, you're getting way ahead of us. We won't talk about linear independence until, just before, maybe even after the first midterm. But you're absolutely right. If I had two vectors in this exactly the same direction, adding them together, I'm never going to be able to move off the common line on which they live. So yeah, there is a condition on these vectors that if you really want to generate a two-dimensional space, you're going to need these to be independent directions. Okay, so we'll come to the that actually becomes a very important question, but we're going to postpone the exceptional cases for a little while until we at least establish our intuition. Okay, so let me close today's lecture by showing one way in which these hyperplanes are going to show up in linear algebra. So one of the first things we're going to study, aside from establishing vectors and how to manipulate them, one of the first things we're going to look at starting next week is going to be how to solve systems of equations using linear algebra techniques. So first let me define what a linear equation is. So here I have an equation, but what makes it linear is the fact that the variables x1 through xn, they all occur in separate terms, right? There's no x1 squared here, nor do I have any term where one variable is multiplying another variable. They're all separated from each other by these plus signs. And these numbers a1 through an, they're to represent particular numbers. So let me give you an explicit example. So one linear equation in three variables. 2 times x1 plus x2 minus the square root of 3 x3 is equal to 5, right? So this is an explicit equation. I substitute in for the number on the right-hand side, b, and my coefficients, 2, 1, and the square root, minus the square root of 3, and then x1, x2, x3 are my variables. The numbers, here we have a factor of 1 multiplying x2, and here we have minus the square root of 3 multiplying x3. Those are the coefficients. 2, 1, and minus the square root of 3. And this number on the right-hand side, not a good name for it. Technical name for it would be the inhomogeneous term. Don't worry so much about nomenclature at this point. It just it plays a different role than these coefficients. But in any given equation, the numbers a1 through an and the number b are going to be stated explicitly. What's going to be unknown are the values of the variable that actually solve the equation. All right, so what I'm going to show you to finish off today's lecture, that anytime you have a linear equation and you have a solution, then the values of that variables x1 through xn for a solution of the equation, formulated as an ordered list, is always going to be a hyperplane inside the space of variables. So that's the state. This is what I'll show you. The solutions of a linear equation is always a hyperplane in the vector space of variables. Since I have n variables, they each gonna correspond to a particular number. If I have a list of n numbers, it's gonna be an n-dimensional vector. Okay? So let me show you this. The first thing you do is you use a little high school algebra to solve this equation 2 for the variable xn. All right? So I hope you can readily surmise how I took all these terms to the right-hand side of the equation and then divided by an. All right, so I can at least solve for one of the variables using the equation directly. And then when I write down a solution vector, well, this equation says that this vector is actually going to solve the equation, then the last component has to be given by this formula. So let's substitute in. Okay, so I replaced the last component of this vector by its formula coming from the original equation. And then what I can do is I can peel off this initial term, this constant term, b divided by an, let's put that in a vector by itself. And then this term involving x1, well, x1 also occurs in the first component. So there's a typo there. What I'm writing is x is equal to 0 all the way down to the last component, b divided by an. And then I should have x1 appears in the first component up here, It doesn't appear in any other component until you reach the last component. And then it'll appear with magnitude an, a1 divided by an times x1. And then x2 will appear in a separate vector, and it'll appear in the second component, and it also will appear in the last component. And finally, xn minus 1 is going to appear, sorry, didn't do this quite right. It's going to be 0, 0, and the second to last component will be x to the n minus 1 times a n minus 1 minus sign divided by a n x n minus 1. So all I've done here is I've taken this vector expression and I've broken it up into a sum of vectors. The first vector doesn't involve any of these variables. The second vector involves only x1. Third vector would only involve x2. And then the last step would be to pull out the common factors of x1 through xn in each of the last n minus 1 terms. And then you see that the solution vector is actually a vector that's constructed from a starting point going a certain distance x1 along one direction, a certain direction x2 along a different direction, dot, 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 plus a certain distance xn minus 1 along a final direction. And so indeed, vectors in the solution have the form of a hyperplane of dimension n minus 1, effectively. Okay, so I'm going to have a lot more to say about linear equations starting on Wednesday, but that's enough for today. So we'll stop here. I hope you enjoy your missing. Can you upload the final missing slide? Yes, I will. I was editing the slides just prior to the lection, and so this last bit is going to be included as soon as I upload it, which will be immediately after class. Okay? So, with that, let me wish you a happy holiday weekend, and I'll see you again on Monday. And again, just wait 5 or 10 minutes for me to upload the edited slides. I finished them just prior to lecturing. That's why I was started the lecture right on time rather than 5 minutes early. But I'll do that immediately. Okay. All right. So have a good weekend.
So for our web assign homework that's due, are we able to do that now, or do we need to wait to finish the matrix part?
No, you can start those problems now.
Okay.
What I intend to do on Wednesday is I'm going to hope if you have trouble understanding the syntax of these WebAssign problems, how to enter vectors, etc., I'll try to do an example of that explicitly in class. But Okay. Really, that first assignment shouldn't take you much more than 15 minutes to do. So don't worry about it. You might have a look at it to see what you're up against.
Yeah.
But don't worry too much about it. You'll have plenty of time.
Okay. So I remember on Wednesday, you said that sometimes the vectors are listed vertically instead of the components are listed vertically instead of
horizontally. Yeah, and that's what I did here. So because it's easier to see how I pulled apart that vector. If I had written them horizontally, it would take a bunch of lines to say the same thing.
Okay, fantastic. Thank you.
Sure.